Well, welcome back, everybody. The news has been dominated of late by obviously not just the impeachment proceedings, but also about the coronavirus spreading around the world. Last Tuesday, the Google Trends Twitter account noted that worldwide search interest for coronavirus symptoms had increased over 1,000% compared to the week before. It also listed the top five searches during that previous 24 hours, and the coronavirus dominated that with searches like how to prevent coronavirus, how does the coronavirus spread. But as much as we might turn to Dr. Google for help, another popular search shows we're kind of confused about this one, because let me tell you what also spiked in searches at the same time. So, I'm not making this up. There was a spike in searches for corona beer virus, because apparently people are under the impression that coronavirus has something to do with corona beer. I'm happy to tell you on this Super Bowl Sunday that the virus and corona beer have nothing in common except their names, which means crown in both Italian and Spanish. So as your pastor, I say, drink up. Actually, I don't say that. That's not the only area where we can get confused about the difference between things. I recently read about a new church, and it meets on Sunday mornings at 11:30. And by 11:25, a lot of people are there beginning to gather and meet and hug each other and greeting. And only instead of sitting in a pew or a chair, they sat on the floor. And once you sit on the floor, the goal is to set an intention, to connect to something higher than yourself. You can devote the time to someone you love, someone who needs strength, someone who needs healing, your sense of God, a feeling like peace. And then the music begins, but it's the music of breathing. The point is to breathe for something beyond you. It's often called the victorious breath. You breathe in through your nose and out through your nose, and you constrict your throat slightly as you exhale to create this kind of rasping, oceanic kind of sound. The goal is to synchronize breath with movement as you build body heat. And when everyone is breathing this way together, the room just reverberates with this deep cosmic oceanic sound. Then comes the message. As the teacher guides inhales and exhales and transitions the congregation from one posture to the next, a steady stream of messages are offered in order to build a personal sense of strength or ease. Things like, share your energy. Remember that you're a gift to this world, so embrace that. Your way of being is a choice. Then they're singing, only it's not really singing as much as it's chanting. Every practice begins and ends with three chants of the word Om, a vibration treated as the primordial seed of the universe. Then comes meditation. There's no guided prayer, but a guided meditation for 15 minutes following the hour-long practice. Often the goal of the meditation is just to find stillness within yourself in the darkened room, to feel your body relax and to observe your thoughts as they pass. Now, the title of the article describing all this was interesting. It was titled, Welcome to Yoga Church. Only it wasn't trying to be a church. It was simply a yoga class. The writer just called it a church because that's what it felt like to her. And it should have, because her confusion actually ran deeper than she realized. Because whether she knew it or not, it was very much a religious event. She had just gone through the practice of Hinduism. Today, we're kicking off a brand new series called So What's the Difference? It's a look at the difference between the Christian faith and other world religions. The difference between Christianity and Judaism, Christianity and Islam, Christianity and other American religious movements such as Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons. We're even going to look at the difference within Christianity between Protestants and Catholics. But today we're going to begin with a look at the difference between Christianity and Eastern religions. Because there is a sense where we can talk about Eastern religion as a whole, meaning religions that originated in the Eastern world, such as India, China, Japan, Southeast Asia. Religions such as Jainism or Sikhism, Shinto, Taoism, and Confucianism. But the most influential in the West are, without a doubt, Buddhism and Hinduism. Buddhism is influential not only because of the number of practicing Buddhists in the United States, estimated to be between 3 and 4 million, mostly comprised of Asian Americans, but because of the number of celebrities that embrace its ideas or have been linked to its practices. And it's an impressive list. Jennifer Aniston, Orlando Bloom, Kate Bosworth, David Bowie, Jeff Bridges, Penelope Cruz, Richard Gere, Goldie Hawn, Kate Hudson, Angelina Jolie, Jennifer Lopez, Brad Pitt, Keanu Reeves, Steven Seagal, Sting, Uma Thurman, Tina Turner, Tiger Woods. Now, Hinduism is influential in a different way. I doubt you could name a single Hollywood celebrity Hindu. But when it comes to Hindu ideas, that's another story. They are very famous. From the Star Wars films to the writings of Eckhart Tolle, from Shirley MacLaine and the New Age movement to Marianne Williamson's Course in Miracles, from yoga to yoga pants, Hinduism is one of the most influential philosophies in our culture. So let's look at both, beginning with the older of the two, which is Hinduism. When you study Hinduism, it's interesting. There's no clearly identified founder. There's no prophet. There's no historical events marking its beginning. There's no institutional structure. There's no real creed. While the philosophy of Hinduism is influential, only 13% of the world's population are practicing Hindus. Most of them live in India. In fact, that's what the word Hindu means. It's a Persian word for Indian. So it is not surprising that the nation of India produced the person who is probably the most famous Hindu to have ever lived, which was Gandhi. Hindus have spiritual teachers known as gurus, and they have wandering holy men known as swamis. They have sacred writings such as the Vedas, the Upanishads, and the Bhagavad Gita. But they're best known and most influential for three big ideas. And when I walk you through these three ideas, you'll say, oh, I know that idea. You just may not have known that it was Hindu. So let me walk you through these three big ideas, beginning with the idea of, yes, the force. It comes from Hinduism. For the Hindu, there is no such thing as one all-powerful personal God who created us. Instead, ultimate reality is Brahman, which is this impersonal oneness, this impersonal force of existence. That force can manifest itself in the form of many gods. Actually, one estimate is that there are 330 million different Hindu gods. But the big three are Brahma, the creator, Vishnu, the preserver, and then Shiva, the destroyer. And that's what Aum is all about. It's not spelled O-M, it's actually spelled A-U-M, and it's made up of those three letters because they symbolically represent Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. And when you say that word, you are bringing up their essence, you're calling on them, and you're worshiping them. Behind all of those gods is one big force or reality called Brahman. Not to make Star Wars a primer on Hinduism, even though it's based on Hindu and New Age ideas, but you can think of Brahman as the force and then the Jedi as the personification of that, the gods. James Cameron has said his Avatar movie is also based on Hindu ideas. In fact, on the idea of one of the Hindu gods taking human form and draws from other aspects of Hindu philosophy as well. So while there are manifestations of Brahman through the millions of gods the Hindus worship, Brahman itself, the reality, is not personal. It's a force, which means that our true selves, what they would call the Atman, is at one with Brahman. Our essence is the same. It's identical to that of Brahman. And so in their thinking, all is one and one is all. Or you could say the force is all and all is the force. Or as you hear some New Age thinkers put it, God is all and all is God. Our problem, they say, is that we're not aware that we're gods. We're not aware of our divine nature. We're not aware that we're part of this force, the Brahman. As a result, we're bound by this life. That's what the law of karma is about, which is the second big idea within Hinduism. Karma is the sum total of your life actions, good and bad. If you don't liberate yourself from this life and embrace your divinity, you're bound to this life and the next life and the next life and the life after that, because Hindus don't believe that life is linear, you know, going from a beginning to an end. Instead, they believe and teach that it is a never-ending circle of life. Yes, that's where the Lion King got that phrase. It is a Hindu idea, circle of life and death and rebirth, which brings up the third big idea of Hinduism, which is the idea of reincarnation. According to Hindu thought, right now, we're all reaping the consequences of what we did in an earlier life. If you had good karma in a past life, then life right now might be pretty good for you. If your life is not good right now, well, you probably did something in a previous life that got you bad karma. Your karma will even determine what you will come back as in your next life, whether you come back as a human or an animal or an insect. What you will be reincarnated into in your next life depends on your karma in this life, which is why Hindus hold all forms of life sacred, especially the cow, and that's because the cow is the symbol of Mother Earth. Now, the solution to all of this is to be liberated from this wheel of life, death, and rebirth by realizing that you, as a self, are an illusion. Or if you remember the Matrix movies, which has, by the way, a fourth installment coming out this year, and was based on Hindu philosophy, you may recall the scene from the first film where Neo goes to the Oracle to see if he is the one. And he meets a little boy there in the waiting room who's bending a spoon. And when he asks the boy how he did that, he said, the secret is to remember there is no spoon. There is no spoon. Everything's an illusion. Everything is the Matrix. Only the impersonal energy, oneness of the energy force of Brahman is real. So you should strive to detach yourself from this life and attain enlightenment. And again, that's like Neo freeing himself from the Matrix. Now, you can try to do that through various forms of yoga, action, and ritual, through knowledge and meditation, and through devotion. In fact, by the way, that's what the word yoga actually means, union with or yoking with something. For Hindus in yoga, that means union with Brahman. But however you try and strap this on, the goal is to lose yourself, to lose your identity in the universal identity of the self in the Brahman. Or as George Lucas put it, let yourself go and just feel the force. That's Hinduism. Now, from Hinduism came Buddhism, which also believes in one large divine essence that we're to tap into in a quest for enlightenment, also believes in reincarnation, also believes in karma. It's just got a little bit more theology to it. Siddhartha Gautama, now known as the Buddha, began his spiritual search in order to find the cause of suffering and how best to eliminate it. In order to gain enlightenment on this issue and from the suffering, he first devoted himself to extreme pleasure. Let me try everything that the world has to offer, and he found that that didn't work. And then he tried extreme asceticism, meaning he deprived himself and his body of food and pleasure and comfort, hoping that would help him to break through the spiritual barrier. It didn't work. It was only when he sat under a tree in deep meditation that enlightenment finally came to him. And by the way, that's the meaning of the word Buddha. It means the enlightened one. And that enlightenment, known as the middle way, because it didn't give in to pleasure, nor did it give in to asceticism, is marked by what is called the Four Noble Truths. And those Four Noble Truths form the heart of Buddhist philosophy. And here are the Four Noble Truths. First, that life is full of pain and suffering. Second, that suffering is caused by the desire or thirst for pleasure or for existence. Third, that the way to liberate yourself from suffering is by eliminating all desire. You just have got to stop wanting, stop craving all those things that are just our illusion of actually being a self. In other words, the idea that everything is ever-changing. There is no you. There is no me. There is no I. There is no universe. It's all illusion. And then the fourth noble truth is that our desire can be eliminated by following an eightfold path. And we'll just throw all this up at once. The Eightfold Path is right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right awareness, and right meditation. And life on the way to enlightenment is the life that devotes itself to those eight attitudes, those eight actions. And the ultimate goal of all this? Nirvana. Nirvana is to be liberated from the endless cycle of death and rebirth by eliminating all desire and all attachment to the illusion of self. That is enlightenment. And it often happens through meditation and flashes of insight. When you're fully enlightened, you enter nirvana. And that comes by following the Eightfold Path. Well, after the Buddha's death, the Buddhist religion did not hang together very well. Today, there are many, many branches of Buddhism. For example, there's Theravada Buddhism, which is found in such countries as Cambodia and Laos and Sri Lanka and Thailand. There's Vajrayana Buddhism, which exists primarily in Mongolia and Tibet, which uses techniques from the world of the occult to try and develop spiritual power. This branch has actually captured the most attention because of the plight of Buddhists in Tibet under Chinese rule, and also because its leader in exile, the Dalai Lama, has become something of a pop culture celebrity. But to Tibetan Buddhists, he's a lot more than a celebrity. He's what is called a bodhisattva. That is someone who has spiritual enlightenment, has attained enlightenment, but out of compassion for the masses of people, refused to enter nirvana in order to come back and guide other people along the path. And these figures are often worshipped at shrines or prayed to like gods. It's believed that the bodhisattvas can actually transfer some of their own karma to people along the way. That's what the Tibetan Buddhists believe the Dalai Lama to be, the 14th reincarnation of an enlightened Buddha or bodhisattva who refused nirvana to help others attain enlightenment. And then there's Mahayana Buddhism, which is a primary form of Buddhism in places like China and Hong Kong and Japan and Vietnam and Taiwan. And there's branches off of those branches, you know, animists who believe in spirits and influence control people's lives, Zen Buddhists who meditate on the vast emptiness within themselves. It is hard to nail Buddhism down because of its many forms. In fact, there was a Dutchman named De Vettering who went to Japan to study Buddhism, and he tells of going to a garden and asking a man named Han San if he was a Buddhist. And Han San said, "Well, I study Zen Buddhism." And De Vettering said, "Well, I know, but are you a Buddhist?" He says, "Well, you know, I don't exist. I change all the time. Every moment I'm different. I exist in the way a cloud exists. A cloud is a Buddhist too. You call me Han San, pretend that I was yesterday what I shall be today, but that's your business. In reality, there is no Han San, so how can an unreal Han San be a Buddhist?" De Vettering said, "All I want to know is whether you're a member of the Buddhist Brotherhood." And Han San said, "Is a cloud a member of the sky?" And that's when De Vettering quit. You know, I'm not getting anywhere with this. So what attracts those of us in the West to the ideas and practices of the East? Why are we so taken with monks and monasteries and temples and shrines and karma and reincarnation and yoga and meditation? I mean, what is the allure of all this to us? I think there's two big things. First is our basic foundational desire to have a spiritual life. And without a doubt, Eastern religions provide the feeling of spirituality. The Tibetan mountaintop monasteries, the shaved heads, the flowing orange robes, the prayer wheels, the incense, the exotic locations, the meditation, it all seems to hold the promise of the experience of the spiritual. But that's often all it is. The outward appearance or feel of spirituality as opposed to an actual robust spirituality itself. I read of an Eastern holy man who covered himself with ashes as a sign of humility and sat on a prominent street corner in his city. When tourists would ask permission to take his picture, he would stop them, rearrange the ashes to give the best image of being destitute and humble, and then when he was done, he said, "Okay, now you can take a picture." Now, was that true humility? Was that true spirituality, or was that posturing, going through motions? I think a second appeal of the East to the West is that it's an easy spirituality, empty of any real accountability. You don't have to join anything or really believe in anything. With Buddhism, it's just the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, which is pretty generic. I mean, you could drive a truck through it. With Hinduism, it's buying into a vague philosophy of a cosmic force, of life as a never-ending cycle and circle, and the need to just try and do better in this life so that you can come out of it better on the other side. Now, that appeals to people who want to be spiritual-ish, but not truly spiritual. Around here, we talk a lot about Christianity being about a relationship, not a religion, meaning it's not a set of do's and don'ts and empty practices and rituals as much as it's about entering into this life-changing relationship with the living God through Jesus. There is a real God that can be encountered, that we are to relate to. He has spoken. He has given us truth about himself and for our lives. What some people want, though, is spirituality without the God, without the absolute, without the authority, which means spirituality just becomes a set of emotions and feelings, and it ends up being little more than the sound of your own voice. So while religions from the East can be attractive, there's enormous tension points with the Christian faith. The Dalai Lama himself has said that you cannot, you know, reconcile Buddhism and Christianity. I mean, the central doctrines of Buddhism and Christianity are absolutely polar opposites. They're not compatible. He has said, you know, when people call themselves a Buddhist Christian or a Christian Buddhist, he says, no, you can't do that because they're totally opposite, and he's completely right. So let me give you the three key differences between Eastern religions and the Christian faith. Here are the big three. The first one has to do with a personal God. Christianity believes in a personal God. Buddhism doesn't even believe in a higher being. Hindus believe in millions of gods that together make up, though, this impersonal force. So in essence, both Hinduism and Buddhism are atheistic religions. They're atheistic. So that's kind of a big divide. Is there a God or not? The idea of a personal God is at the heart of the Christian faith. A God who loves us, cares about us, wants to be in a personal relationship with us, knows our name. Which raises a second huge difference between Christianity and the religions of the East. What is our greatest need? What is our greatest need? To the Hindu, the biggest problem is bad karma in a previous life. So work your butt off in this one, and maybe you can break free and become part of the divine energy of the universe. To the Buddhist, the biggest problem is that you actually believe you're here, that you actually believe you are alive. So the goal is to get enlightened and realize you aren't even here. Christianity says, no, our deepest problem is that we're estranged from the God who created us, which means we've got some real issues to face. We're real live human beings who are on this planet living the one and only life that we've been given to live. The heart of Jesus' message to the world is that we're not right with God, but we can be. We can be. Which is why Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Why? They'll be filled. Righteousness just means rightness, a rightness with God. It's the desire to see God's standards, God's values established in every area of your life as a result of your relationship with Him, where He takes up residence in your life. The heart of the human problem is not the need for enlightenment or reincarnation. The problem is our sin. The one word we hate to hear, the one thing we try to escape, the one thing we try to deny, the one thing we don't want to own, face, or admit to, in truth, is the one great reality of our life and the heart of the problem of our life. In her book, Traveling Mercies, Anne Lamott writes of a doctor friend who used to shoot up sodium pentothal in his garage and then make a run for the bedroom where he would pass out for the night. He was convinced that he had a problem with insomnia, not drugs. Another of her friends had to have surgery to remove pebbles from his forehead. The tiny stones got embedded while he was smashing his face against the pavement at the end of a cocaine binge. When he told her about his operation, he was angry because he says, now people are going to think I've got a drug problem. Yeah. Folks, if we fail to see what the nature of our problems are, what the nature of our challenges really are, what the essence of our struggles really are, we'll never be able to address them. We'll just live a life in denial. We need a personal God. There is one. And we need to see that we're not right with this God, but we can be. Which brings us to the third major divide. How are we going to deal with our brokenness? How do you deal with our brokenness? Christianity believes that the sin and failure in our life can be met with grace and forgiveness from God, and that reaching the ultimate goal of eternity with Him is not something we have to earn, but something that is given to us freely out of the love of God, if we'll just come home to Him for relationship. Not so those buying into karma and reincarnation. It is a brutal, vicious cycle where all you get is what you have deserved, what you've earned. And good, bad, or ugly, there's no grace, there's no forgiveness, there's no mercy. You are alone with your life, period. You may have heard of the famous story Jesus told of the prodigal son. I'm going to read it to you, And then I'm going to give the one, you know, the story that Jesus told. And then I'm going to give you the Eastern version. See which one you like better. A man had two sons. The younger son told his father, "I want my share of your estate now, instead of waiting until you die." So his father agreed to divide his wealth between his sons. A few days later, this younger son packed all his belongings, took a trip to a distant land, and there he wasted all of his money on wild living. About the time his money ran out, a great famine swept over the land, and he began to starve. He persuaded a local farmer to hire him to feed his pigs. The boy became so hungry that even the pods he was feeding the pigs looked good to him, but no one gave him anything. When he finally came to his senses, he said to himself, "Well, at home, even the hired men have food enough to spare, and here I am dying of hunger. I will go home to my father, and I'll say, 'Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. Please just take me on as a hired man.'" So he returned home to his father. And while he was still a long distance away, his father saw him coming. Filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son, and he embraced him, and he kissed him. And his son said to him, "Father, I've sinned against both heaven and you, and I'm no longer worthy of being called your son." But his father said to the servant, "Quick, bring the finest robe in the house. Put it on him. Get a ring for his finger, sandals for his feet. Kill the calf we've been fattening in the pen. We must celebrate with a feast, for this son of mine was dead and is now returned to life. He was lost, but now is found." So the party began. Jesus told that story for one reason. He wanted us to see the heart of God toward us, his children, a heart full of forgiveness and grace and mercy. And it is a story of grace. It's not a story of karma. Here's the story based on karma, according to an ancient Asian legend that tells the story of another man who had a wayward son. The boy became involved with the wrong crowd, who persuaded him to join them in a robbery of his own father. After the robbery was over, his friends fled with the stolen treasure and left him to face the guilt of the crime alone. Deserted by his friends and realizing that he had betrayed his father, he went home and begged for forgiveness. The father granted it. And then he called all the members of the family together to celebrate this reconciliation and the return of his son. When all had enjoyed the banquet to the fullest, the father stood and lifted a cup of rice wine for a toast and had his servant bring a cup of rice wine to his son so they could have this toast together. As the son drank the contents of his cup, he suddenly dropped the cup, grabbed his throat, and fell lifeless across the table, foaming at the mouth. The father had poisoned his cup. The whole banquet and celebration was to make a public statement of his revenge of his son. That's the difference between karma and grace. Only Christianity contends that God's love is unconditional and you don't have to earn it. So, what about some of these practices, though, of the East that we kind of like? I mean, let's talk about the elephant in the room. And what about yoga? Is that always bad to be rejected? Well, listen, there's no doubt that it's entered into innocently by millions as a way to pursue physical health. People find the stretching and the breathing techniques to be extremely positive for their lives, both physically and emotionally. They don't view it as a Hindu practice, but as, I mean, it's just a yoga class, like a Pilates class or something else, with yoga not meaning anything more than a particular kind of workout. And one of the reasons why we're so low-key about its Hindu origins and yoga being a Hindu religious act is because of one of the big differences between the East and the West in terms of culture. In the West, we tend to be word people. We're doctrine people, idea people, beliefs people. That's what faith is about for us and what we believe. Not so much in the East. They are practice people and experience people. We think our way into spirituality. They tend to act their way into it. And so one of the reasons why we're so low-key about this is because when we go to a yoga class, they don't begin in a Western way by saying, "By the way, you're getting ready to enter into a Hindu act. Here are all the Hindu philosophies and beliefs that are behind it. Will you please read this and sign it as a disclaimer before you participate?" If they did, it'd freak you out. But it's just a practice. It's just an experience. So we walk in with our eyes wide shut. because of the way it's pitched. This is why movements used in yoga are deeply symbolic gestures that express religion, and they indoctrinate people into a religion through experience. In fact, if you go to India and you talk to Hindus there, which I have, it's seen as the primary evangelistic tool of Hinduism for the West. They'll be very upfront with you about it. They love how yoga has taken over America because they say that's how we're doing evangelism. That's how we're converting people to Hinduism without them even knowing they're being evangelized. The whole purpose of yoga is to indoctrinate people into Hinduism and to create a oneness with the impersonal force of the universe as manifested in the hundreds of millions of gods, to break you into the idea of your own godhood. Even the most commonly practiced type of yoga in America, which is Hatha yoga, is considered a path toward enlightenment. For Hindus, that means a liberation, not only into your divinity, and to make contact with the power of the universe and to break you free from the cycle of reincarnation. Now, a lot of yoga teachers water that down a bit and make it simply a point where you achieve stillness in your mind or you understand the true nature of the world and your place in it. But that's just the way it's being served up soft on the front end. It is a spiritual exercise, and everything about yoga is designed to serve the Hindu spiritual journey. Even the yoga positions have meaning. For example, many yoga practices open with a series of positions known as the Surya Namaskar. What people don't often know is that those are a series of positions designed to welcome and to greet Surya, the Hindu sun god. So, is it okay for Christians to do yoga? Well, if you take a yoga class that is tied to its Hindu roots, with Hindu philosophy littered throughout, including Hindu chants to one of the pagan gods, no, it's not okay. If you're being called to make references to a life force or cosmic energy, and you end by greeting each other by saying namaste, which is Sanskrit for I bow to the God within you, no, that's not okay. If you're encouraged to repeat the sacred Hindu word om, which Hindus and Buddhists believe is the primordial sound that brought the universe into being and lifts up the three main Hindu gods in worship, no, it's not okay. If you're hearing phrases like breathe in positive energy and breathe out negative energy, focus on the third eye, get in touch with the divinity within you, it's not okay. Hindu yoga is aimed at transforming human consciousness to experience an energy tied to Hindu gods, which means you're not simply dabbling with a false religion, you have entered the world of the occult. And that is true of other Eastern religious practices, such as feng shui, or even some aspects of alternative medicine. If it's about tapping into some kind of spiritual energy or some kind of personal energy within you, that is a worldview that comes from the occult, that is not of the Bible. The bottom line is this, whatever you're attempting to call upon or tap into, if it's a power that is not the power of the biblical God, there's only one other source, the evil one. And you're opening yourself up to the world of the occult, which is just nightmarish. Nightmarish. So don't do it. So is something like yoga ever okay? Yeah, I think it can be. A yoga class that is stripped of its origins, stripped of its Hindu philosophy, reduced to the stretches, reduced to the breathing, can be just a physical exercise. There's nothing demonic about putting your leg over your neck. It might hurt like hell, but that doesn't make it from hell. There are even Christian yoga classes where everything from Hinduism is replaced with Christian alternatives. Yoga that is led and informed with a Christian worldview also is going to handle the meditative element differently, and well, it should, because in Hindu yoga, the goal of meditation is to empty yourself, to empty your mind, which again is a very occult idea. Christian meditation is the exact opposite. It's about filling yourself, filling your mind with the truth of God. So just like the martial arts can be stripped of much of its Eastern philosophy and religious moorings and become a healthy sport or workout regimen, so can yoga. But having said all that, and talking about everything that attracts us and the differences between the East and West, understand it's not about East versus West. It's not just about, oh, it's just two different cultures, it's a cultural thing. No. Friends, we're better thinkers than that. This is about whether there's a God. That's not an East-West divide. That's like all of human history divide. Is there a God or not? And it's about what is ultimately wrong in our life that needs to be fixed and how that can be addressed. Christianity says there's a personal God that we can be in a personal relationship with. Your problem, my problem, is being estranged from him, not being in a right relationship with him. Christianity doesn't call for more enlightenment or even think enlightenment is the main problem. Christianity says that what we really need is God. And it's a God that we need who wants nothing more than to give of himself to us. And thank God, not based on our karma, but based on his grace. I once read an interview with Bono from, you know, the group U2, talking about what draws him to Christianity and has made him even more committed to his Christian faith now than ever before. And he says, you know, the one thing that keeps him on his knees is the difference between grace and karma. And in the interview, he talked about how every other religion just seems driven by karma. You know, what you put out comes back to you, every action met by an equal or opposite action. And then he says, along comes an idea like grace. It just upends it all. And he says, for me, this is very good news indeed, because I've done a lot of stupid stuff. It doesn't excuse my mistakes, but I'm holding out for grace. I'm holding out that Jesus took my sins onto the cross because I know who I am, and I hope I don't have to depend on my own religiosity. He's right. That's the difference. Karma or amazing grace. Well, let's stand for a quick closing prayer. We're just getting this series kicked off, friends. We're going to go fast and fly really high on this. So next week, we're turning the page and tackling a totally different world religion and how it compares and contrasts to Christianity. Next week's Judaism, all things Jewish. Jesus was a Jewish man, is raised in the Jewish faith, was a Jewish rabbi. Why aren't we playing well in the sandbox now? What's the problem? What is the difference between Christianity and Judaism? What made the break happen? And what is how much of Judaism and Jewish faith is still relevant to the Christian faith? And it's going to be a fascinating conversation that I think is going to raise up a lot of questions you probably have had, not just about Judaism, but about the Christian faith. And hopefully we'll get some good answers to those. So I hope that you'll be here for that. Let me pray. Father, thank you so much for all that we're going to be learning in this series. And I just pray specifically for those who are still tire-kicking everything, haven't made up their mind, trying to explore everything, and this series came about at just the right time for them. So I hope that it really does help bring some clarity to their thinking about all the differences that exist between Christianity and other faiths. For those of us who are already Christ followers, I pray that this will just help us to know why we believe what we believe, to drive deep our faith and to understand how unique the Christian faith is and how scandalous the particularity Jesus' teaching was. And all of that, Father, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.